This week in Studio 360, we're on stage at the Aspen Ideas Festival trying to imagine a brighter tomorrow. A master inventor explains how to get kids jazzed about reducing carbon emissions.
So you tell a 10-year-old kid, in your future, the green future, you're going to go to school on a zip line. They are all over it.
And Susan Orlean has some time-honored advice from dear old dad.
Even after Meryl Streep had played me, a writer, in a major motion picture, my father nagged me to go to law school. So that just in case being a writer didn't work out, I'd have something to fall back on.
Plus, a cautionary tale from They Might Be Giants.
And nobody knows what it's really like, but everyone says it's great.
And it's the Great American Reset. That's ahead today in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. And by TiVo, recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube, all on the TiVo Romeo DVR. TiVo.com.
Hi, this is Kurt Anderson. We recorded this show live at the Aspen Ideas Festival back in 2009. You remember 2009. There was a big X-Men movie that summer, and Barack Obama was president. But in some ways, it does seem like a very long time ago. Enjoy the show.
This is Studio 360, live from the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. Now, to me, the economic crash and meltdown is a little like a good news, bad news joke. The bad news, you know. The good news is that we've now got a chance in almost every part of American life to rethink, reform, rejigger, reinvent. And that is our loose theme for this show, the Great American Reset. I will be joined by a couple of amazing authors, the novelist Curtis Sittenfeld and the journalist Susan Orlean, also a great inventor, Saul Griffith. And with me on stage right this second and ready to go are John Flansburg, John Linnell, and Marty Beller, my favorite band, They Might Be Giants.
This song is called We Live in a Dump.
Hanging out while the monkeys type away. Waiting in my room all day. Why be realistic? We live in a dump, admit it's a dump. Our friends are all nuts, and half of them drunks. And if they're not nuts, then they're retired nuts. And that might be the hardest nut. Making plans, the kind that go awry. Good about that. I hear they're the eggs, and when the eggs hatch, you gotta believe them. There's related madness from the lead that's in the ceiling. What? We live in a dump. Admit it's a dump. Our friends are all nuts. The other half monks. And if they're nuts, then they're retired nuts. And that might be the hardest nut. We live in a dump.
John Flansburg, John Linnell, Marty Beller, They Might Be Giants. There's that great lyric in the They Might Be Giants song, Why Be Realistic, Don't Wake From the Dream, leads me more perfectly than I could have imagined to some thoughts I have. And I have, for instance, a question. Exactly when
did adults start celebrating Halloween? Childless adults, I mean. And maybe it was around the time that people over 12 started eating Pop-Tarts. Maybe we baby boomers have been taking a certain Bob Dylan song too literally.
Forever young. Forever young.
Think about it. Back in 1963 and 1964, when I was 9 years old, my friends and I were all a-Twitter about the first X-Men comic book, the new G.I. Joe action figure, and the Beatles. The pilot for Star Trek had just been produced. At home, I wore blue jeans and sneakers. I was a kid, unlike my father or any other grown-up I knew. 2009, almost half a century later, people my age are going to theaters to see X-Men and Star Trek movies. Paul McCartney was the headliner at this year's Coachella Music Festival. I wear jeans and sneakers at home and at the office and pretty much everywhere else. 1964, if it's small and plastic, has buttons and beeps, it is by definition a toy. 2009, for my birthday, I'm getting a new iPhone. Small, plastic, buttons, beeps. Now, adults of my parents' generation did not play army. Now, you can spend the weekend in camouflage firing paintballs at your friends. And what are SUVs but enormous, dangerous army toys? 9-year-old me would have been creeped out to meet a grown-up who read Fantastic Four or Batman. Now, adults buy most of the comic books and buy most of the video games as well. And art. I don't think it's a coincidence that the celebrated American artists of my generation specialize in kiddie media. Think about Keith Haring's doodles or Cindy Sherman's photos of herself playing dress-up. These days, if you want to ask how somebody's job is going, even if she's a deputy attorney general or a CFO, the standard form of the question is, are you having fun? Waiting to get what you want is a definition of maturity. Demanding satisfaction right this instant is the definition of a 7-year-old. But instant satisfaction has been driving our economy and our culture for a while. Send a message now. Get an answer now. Pick your airline seat now. Buy anything you want right now. The web, cell phones, FedEx, they all indulge the impulsive child in every one of us. Save? Why? For what? Wait till I can afford it? No, phooey. Fuel efficient? Lame. I don't mean to be a crank, and I don't mean to condemn fun. I'm committed to rubber soles for life, and I cherish The Simpsons. I'm even a convert to Twitter, the official medium of back-of-the-class wisecracks. Yes, the economic collapse had everything to do with credit policies and financial regulation. But I really, truly think that this 40-year-long celebration of our inner child helped lead us to the spree that we've just come off. Yes. But with this crisis and now the rebuilding and reshaping of America that we're required to do, we boomers have maybe our last best shot to suck it up and get serious and help straighten out the messes that we helped make. Maybe it's not too late to grow up a little. Thank you.
You're older than you've ever been, and now you're even older, and now you're even older, and now you're even older. You're older than you've ever been, and now you're even older, and now you're older still. Time is marching on. time. Is still marching on. This day will soon be at an end, and now it's even sooner, and now it's even sooner, and now it's even sooner. This day will soon be at an end, and now it's even sooner, and now it's sooner still. Been, and now you're even older, and now you're even older, and now you're even older. You're older than you've ever been, and now you're even older, and now you're older still.
You are listening to Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we're at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. That song was called Older, and my next guest has been thinking lately about what it means to get older, or at least what it used to mean. Susan Orlean is best known as the author of The Orchid Thief, and her latest book is called Lazy Little Loafers. It's a children's book. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker and one of the finest observers of life in America that I know. Susan, welcome.
Thank you.
Before we go on, lazy little loafers, you don't mean shoes.
No, I in fact mean the babies that ought to be factored into our full employment program. It's a book about raising the question of why children don't have jobs and, you know, and what we can do about it.
And you've got a four-year-old, so one of those
working.
Underemployed
he's
millions.
Working. That's why he's not here tonight. He's working.
There you go. But rather than talk about the next generation directly, you're going to talk about the last generation and the sort of gigantic resets that our parents' generation endured. Take it away.
All right. My father, Arthur Orlean, was born during World War I, served in World War II, came into his own during the Depression. He was part of the generation that is known in shorthand as the greatest. They were considered the greatest because they were brave, they were resourceful, and they were inventive. But most of all, I think their greatness lay in their resilience and optimism to ride out what were often sour times. In the last few months, as I've watched the economy curdle and my confidence in the future flatten, I've thought about this gift for optimism and wondered how my father came by it and whether I'll find it in myself. Does optimism pass down directly, or does it skip generations, just like eye color does? My father's father, for instance, was undone by his life's downturns. He had deserted the Tsar's army in Russia around the turn of the century and made his way, hat in hand, to America. Working as a carpenter and then on a modest scale as a developer, Sam Orlean made a just barely middle-class life for my grandmother and their four children. When the stock market crashed in 1929, my grandfather lost his buildings one by one. The Depression left him wary and disillusioned. He refused to even try to rebuild his business once the economy revived. And he told my father he never wanted to own another building and would never work for himself again. The effect of the Depression on my father was nearly the opposite. He accepted it as a challenge. He was only 14, but he started working. He worked through high school, worked through college, and after his years in the Army, eked out enough to pay for law school. Ignoring the bitterness of my grandfather's real estate experience, my father decided to become a developer. He built a few buildings, made good on them, built a few more. Eventually, my grandfather went to work for my father, becoming his own son's employee. That arrangement made concrete this essential difference in how they managed hardship, how differently they metabolized a new reality. The world I grew up in was a product of that difference. Instead of a legacy of shrinking expectations from my grandfather, I am my father's daughter. And his perspective was that opportunity was expansive, almost limitless. I miss my dad in a million ways, but never as much as I have recently, as I've felt the seismic shifts in the world and wondered where we'll be after it settles. I wish I knew how my father became a person who saw change and even dramatic failure as motivating rather than immobilizing. I also realize quite wistfully that I finally understand him now much better than I ever did. As much of an optimist as he was, he never had a casual attitude towards money or material comfort, something I am coming now to understand. Having been formed entirely by the comfortable life he built for us, I used to find his little frugalities annoying and his concern about being practical stifling. Until the day he died, even after I'd published 7 books, even after I'd been on staff at The New Yorker for 15 years, even after Meryl Streep had played me, a writer, in a major motion picture, my father nagged me to go to law school so that just in case being a writer didn't work out, I'd have something to fall back on. I thought it was a ridiculous suggestion, since I just never imagined there could be a fall. My father passed away a little less than 2 years ago. He had a lot in his life, but he never took any of it for granted, ever. I believe that if he had lost it all, he wouldn't have been happy, but he wouldn't have collapsed in despair, wouldn't have felt robbed, wouldn't have been mad at the world. He would have begun again, as he had before, not loving the deprivation, but certainly accepting the challenge, maybe even excited by the idea that what would emerge would be possibly better than what he'd lost, and at the very least, it would be something new. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Susan Orlean on stage here at the Belly Up Nightclub at the Aspen Ideas Festival. Susan, you mentioned your father's little frugalities, and having had parents of that generation, I think I know exactly what you mean. What are some of the specifics that even after he could afford whatever he wanted, he still...
Well, I think what captured it for me was my dad loved cars, and at one point, and he was very successful, at one point he had a beautiful vintage Rolls Royce, he had a very expensive Mercedes sport car, but he still insisted on saving old coffee cans and old tuna fish cans and nailing them into the wall in our garage and using them to keep, you know, nails and screws and bolts. And I would say, Dad, there's the Container Store. You can get, like, really nice. And he said, what's wrong with these? These are perfectly good. He, in fact, I actually ended up with this beautiful, one of his beautiful cars. And the other day I was laughing because I'd gotten in the car, and my dad, rather than buying fancy Mercedes custom floor mats, took some old carpet from the house and cut it to go in the car. And, you know, it worked. It worked. And there is a disconnect between people who made their own way in the world and people who are born into comfort. And it's understandable. And my father made his own way in the world, and he built all these buildings. And my brother, after being a lawyer, yes, went to work for my dad. And my father used to say, you know, I know every single apartment in every one of these buildings that I own. And your brother has a different attitude because he simply had them, he inherited them. And that's, it's got to create an enormous disconnect in how you look at money, but even how you look at values.
But as you now have this young son and are raising him, are you going to try to figure out ways of making him not have the downside of having it all given to him?
I remember one day when I was a teenager, my father just looked me in the eye and he said, I just want to make one thing clear to you. You are not a member of the idle rich. And it meant something, and it actually stuck with me forever, I think. And I, by the same token, I feel strongly that, first of all, By the time this economy continues collapsing, my son won't have the opportunity to be a member of the Idle Rich.
And if you
anyway,
keep doing so, public radio, you'll never be a member of the Idle Rich. Susan Orlean is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her latest book is called Lazy Little Loafers. Thanks, Susan.
Thank you.
And this is Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. We are at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. When we come back, more from They Might Be Giants. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. And by TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus, all on a single screen. Available at TiVo.com.
Today's Studio 360 is one of our favorite live shows, recorded in 2009.
This is Studio 360. We are at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado, on stage at the Belly Up nightclub. And we're talking today about some lessons we might be able to learn from this economic collapse and the necessary rebuild. With me are They Might Be Giants, now with a song called Careful What You Pack.
From the shore, never knew before, doesn't understand. She's in trouble now. It's a new
Giants. John Flansburgh on guitar and vocals, John Linnell on keyboard, and Marty Beller on drums. Now, Giants.
Yes.
I was struck by this recent sort of public communique you made.
And we've gone public.
And made a list of words that no one in the band is allowed to say.
Well, this is, comes from our drummer, Marty Beller, who has been harboring these resentments about overused phrases that don't actually, that no longer mean it, have lost their flavor like chewing gum over time. And he finally has proscribed them.
For instance?
Phone tag is what started it. Jump the shark, or one of the newest ones, it is what it is. That has no meaning. That's just a placeholder for language. I have to add that most importantly, the list itself is actually on the list.
Really?
I'm so overused.
How meta.
Welcome to They Might Be Giants, Kurt.
Now, since you are the world's arbiter of this problem, we want to try an experiment going to the audience here at the Belly Up and find out if any of them has such a phrase that they find bothersome, and then you will be the judge about whether that could make the list or is on the list.
Gladly.
So we have...
LOL, laugh out loud, what is that?
Winner.
You've
That's
won.
Right, answer.
A winner for being a loser, I guess, is what we have here today. We have lots. Yes.
Emily from Denver. Slap your mama. Why would you do that?
Marty.
Marty's not going for
it. I don't think you should slap your mama, but it's not good enough for the list. I'm sorry.
That might be real expression.
There's no there there.
Oh, a winner. Winner.
A winner.
I've said that.
Susan, you're going to offer one?
Yes. Blank is the new blank.
Yeah.
Thank you.
There you go. Good.
Well done, Susan.
Whatever it is.
Diana from Paraguay. It's very complex.
No, some things are very complex. I don't know.
Of the members of the band, who's the worst offender?
Oh, God.
They're not here.
Oh, really? I'm not sure I believe that.
I actually made Marty create a special dispensation for using the expression no worries in a business context. Because I, as someone who has to take on a lot of the business responsibility for the band in a lot of highly emotional situations, it is an incredibly useful thing to be able to say no worries.
You know, I once
But you can't say it to your wife.
No worries? Why? Because they're already always
because
worries?
That's because that you might as well just be smiling and saying shut up.
Right, unless you're doing business with your
I once heard a band, I swear to God, described as they might be giants on steroids. Would that qualify?
On steroids.
Yeah.
On steroids is on the list. On LSD, on steroids.
And from hell.
And from hell are all on the list.
Really? So
yeah. That, on steroids from hell is
And if I just say
list.
I've gone off the reservation, no good. And then I would say, oh, sorry, my bad.
Ooh, you're getting to the core.
And I guess at this point I am jumping the shark.
Yeah.
I guess what I need to do is play the host card and and change the subject. You guys have released a number of incredibly popular children's records, and now I'm so afraid even to talk to you for fear that Marty's going to to bell me again.
Right.
Your next record is about science?
Yes,
we kids record.
Yeah, when we first got into doing kids stuff, we actually tried to very steadfastly avoid pretending that we were educators. But you know, in the fullness of time, we realized there's nothing more wonderful than pretending you're an educator.
As many educators do.
Exactly. But we did hire a science consultant on this record. Eric Siegel from the New York City Hall of Science basically fact-checked everything we did on the record.
So yeah. What are you going to play off the record?
Well, we were going to perform this next song.
The sun is a mass of incandescent gas, a gigantic nuclear furnace. Where hydrogen is built into helium at a temperature of millions of degrees.
We were going to perform that song. It was actually the very first sort of fact-based song that we ever recorded.
Yeah, that's not
years
a
ago.
New song.
It's a song from the 50s. It was written by Hi Zaret, and it was on a children's record that I think was written in one very spirited afternoon. All the words are actually from an encyclopedia entry, and it pretty much stops rhyming after the first couplet. And it's extremely filled with facts and seems serious, untouchable. And in fact, when we were talking to Eric, we only sent him the video.
Your science advisor.
Yes, our science advisor. We sent him the video to just make sure that everything in the video was factually correct, because we were very sure that everything in the song was factually correct.
Because it came from an encyclopedia.
Exactly. The Wikipedia of an earlier age. And you know, he basically informed us that not only was the song completely wrong, but we actually should probably leave it off the record.
But now in penance, you have another song.
So basically, in the proud tradition of country music, we have created an answer song to ourselves. And so now we're going to perform for you the song, Why Does the Sun Really Shine?
The sun is a miasma of incandescent plasma.
The sun is a miasma of incandescent plasma. The sun's not simply made out of gas. No, no, no. The sun is a quagmire. It's not made of fire. Forget what you've been told in the past. Plasma! Electrons are free.
Plasma!
A full state of matter, not gas. Whoa. Not liquid, not solid. The sun is the red dwarf. I hope it never morphs into a supernova collapse. Orb, 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 orb. The sun is a quagmire. It's not made of fire. I forget what I was told by myself. Elf, elf, elf.
Plasma.
Electrons are free.
Plasma.
Full state of matter, not gas. Whoa. Not liquid, not solid.
Plasma.
Forget that song.
This is Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, live at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. More from They Might Be Giants and inventor Sol Griffith when we return. Stay with us.
The Aspen Ideas Festival takes place every summer in Aspen, Colorado, and we recorded this show at the festival in 2009.
From the belly up in Aspen, Colorado, this is Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Our show today is part of the Aspen Ideas Festival, which is a gathering of hundreds of interesting and influential people who try to solve the world's problems before lunch. Today we are asking our guests what we can do post-crash to get our country and our lives back on track. Sol Griffith, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
Sol is a scientist, an inventor, founder of a whole bunch of companies, and like They Might Be Giants, you also have a sort of kids' media project. How did that get started?
So I had a privileged childhood where my mother was an artist, so half of our house was a studio, and my father was an engineer and I guess an inventor, so the other half of this house was a workshop, and we slept in the backyard. And so
that sounds fun.
It was fabulous, absolutely fabulous, and the concept in our house was always, you know, you always made everything yourself, and I think it was a great childhood, and I wanted to give some of that back to the world. And so I teamed up with a guy who actually illustrates Spider-Man as his day job, and we write science comic books for kids that just teach them the passion and the joy of, you know, seeing the world for what it could be.
You also have a more non-kids project, as I understand it, that uses kites to generate power, which sounds like something a 12-year-old would have come up with.
Right. There's this huge untapped source of energy called wind at high altitude. So you can only build towers so high, and then it gets too expensive. So how do you extract power from the wind at much higher altitudes? And so you have to build something that looks like a kite. So curiously, every child's favorite plaything may in fact save the world.
And does this seem to be working or could work?
It works great at small scale, and now we have to make it bigger and bigger and bigger. I haven't been able to convince anyone to give me their private jet to run experiments yet.
Well, there are probably a few private jets in the audience.
I know the audience specifically requesting. I could rip the fuselage off your private jet and make a 5-megawatt wind turbine and power all of Aspen. So
if you're serious about green energy out there... Now, I also am told that you perform at birthday parties.
Well, I get my sanity and also, well, as they might be giants, get their ideas from the audience. I actually steal all my ideas, as you've noticed, from 10 to 12-year-old kids. Because, you know, when you become an old inventor, you sort of run out of ideas. And so you go to these birthday parties or we do school workshops, and I love to just ask these 10-year-olds, if you could invent anything, what would you invent? And so if it's a 10-year-old boy, 95% of the time they say flying skateboard. And then you just sort of go through, oh, well, we could do that. You just need to design a skateboard with wings this big or magnetic levitation. If it's a 10-year-old girl, she'll say, I'd like to design a machine that can read the dreams of my friend and play them back to me. And then you're like, that's really hard. So, but I actually...
That's why girls are better than boys.
It's absolutely true. These girls are astounding. And I say, well, you know, the boys thing is already a solved problem. We could have flying skateboards today if we wanted them. But your problem is a 30-year problem. You should go into neuroscience. And then I describe to them... I describe to them the experiments that they run at Harvard, where they take black and white movies, typically westerns with Clint Eastwood on a horseback, and they cut the back off the head of a cat, and they stick electrodes in the back of the visual cortex, and they play the western movies at them. And with very sensitive equipment, you can actually receive the image of Clint Eastwood, it's a bit fuzzy, at the back of the brain of the cat.
Now you say, kids, don't try this at home, I assume, right?
So actually, at 10 years old, kids love this stuff, and they're like all over it. And then you say, this is the early experiments in how you get to building the machine that can read the dreams of your friend, and yada, yada.
I thought... In the real world, in the 21st century, scientists were supposed to be hyper-specialized. You sound like, you know, some children's book or somebody from the 19th century or some Nikola Tesla guy who tries to do everything. Why? You're odd.
You've been speaking to my mother. yeah. So I guess there's a bit of a misconception. I think the best scientists I know are very multidisciplinary. And the best science that is done is the breakthrough science at sort of the boundary of a two or three different disciplines. And quite frankly, this may be part of the problem, the 10-year-old problem. They think to grow up and be a scientist, you're going to be unbelievably boring. You'll know everything about solar plasma, and you'll be able to correct these guys when they sing their song. Whereas really, science is just a great lifelong adventure where you trip from one idea into the next, and then you have a conversation with someone here, and it's like, holy cow, I want to now work on that.
You've written that you think if the people of planet Earth could agree on a target, or even the people of the United States, a target for CO2 and how we want to bring the levels down, that once that was decided definitively, the engineers and scientists of the world could get us there. You have a strong conviction that that's the case.
Absolutely. If we had the conviction to say 450 parts per million was the maximum CO2 concentration we want in the atmosphere, engineers with that goal, engineers just like doing stuff. They just, you know, the engineers are, you know, twiddling their thumbs waiting for the politicians to say, just do it. You just say 450, the engineers I know can do that and they can do it today. If you say 400, they don't know how to do that. 350, which is what some people argue for, we don't actually know how to do that because we're past it. But very realistically, engineers could go out and do all of this. And in terms of, you know, a time for that American inventor to reemerge, this really is the time. We basically have to reinvent all of the bad habits. So make everything, you know, you hear about this in terms of efficiency. So we need to make cars that are 10 times better. We need to figure out ways of giving me a glass of water that don't come in a plastic cup that will last for 10 million years, right? There's everything around you is broken, which for me is like the world's so exciting right now. Everything can be reinvented. And for 10-year-olds, there's been a unique failure of vision to communicate to these kids that, no, the world could be brilliant. I mean, remember the space program. We were all going to be walking on the moon, and you'd be there with your dog, and your dog would be walking around in zero gravity with a fishbowl on its head. And
we could do that, though.
We could do that, right? The world was going to be fabulous. We need to paint that vision of possibility that this new green world for kids is absolutely fabulous. And so I thought a little bit more about this, thinking we might need some examples. So there's this curious thing. The two most energy-efficient forms of transport we know, in terms of people per unit of energy, are roller coasters and zip lines. So you tell a 10-year-old kid, in your future, the green future, you're going to go to school on a zip line, or actually halfway to school on a zip line, and then the last bit on a roller coaster. They are all over it. So we need to give this positive vision. The future is going to be great.
Saul Griffith, You are, in every sense, fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. We are here at the Aspen Ideas Festival. Curtis Sittenfeld is the author of the novel Prep and last year's best-selling novel American Wife. American Wife was a novel about a first lady who seems very, very, very much like Laura Bush. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome Curtis Sittenfeld.
I always thought the secret to finishing novels, at least for me, consisted of three things. I've never lived in New York, I've never had a blog, and I've never had kids. Well, I still don't live in New York, and I still don't have a blog, but in March, I gave birth to a baby girl. I haven't written a word of fiction since. What's been most striking to me about this particular reset in my life is the intensity of it, especially compared to being a writer. Don't get me wrong, I appreciate being able to support myself by writing. But there's nothing like experiencing something supposedly glamorous firsthand to make it completely lose its mystique. I imagined giving readings would be exciting until I found myself in Jackson, Mississippi, at a bookstore where so few people showed up that the employees removed their name tags and pretended to be customers. On most days, being a novelist feels incredibly mundane. I sit at my desk wearing sweatpants, imagining the lives of other people. And then I gave birth to my daughter. Having kids is one of life's most ordinary, common experiences, and it's utterly shocking to me. Like, the baby comes out of where? And then you feed it with what part of your body? I think my friend Susanna, who's also a new mom, put it best. She said, "I can't believe there was something with eyes inside me." My daughter is 4 months old now, and there are still several times a day, especially if she's been napping and I've turned my attention to something else, that I see her again and think, "Oh my God, a tiny human being has appeared in my home." When we put her in her car seat, I'm enthralled by the way she rapidly kicks her legs because she's excited to be going somewhere. And when she's about to start eating, how she snorts and grunts like a pig hunting for truffles. Why didn't anyone ever tell me about all this? Now I spend my days carefully considering how many times a pacifier can bounce against which surfaces before it needs to be washed. And the most recent piece of literature I've read is titled Woof Woof. I've read it 30 times. So what if I'm not producing any fiction? I'm still using my writing skills. The other day, I was changing my daughter, and my husband watched as I fiddled with the tape, trying to make sure everything was aligned precisely and fastened securely. Then he said, "Do you realize that you're revising her diaper?" But perhaps the biggest shift of all has been that as a novelist, I was used to being an inconspicuous observer of others. Now that I have a baby, there's nothing inconspicuous about me. My husband and I have become those annoying people hauling our car seat into restaurants, taking up most of the sidewalk with our stroller. Even my more minimalist baby sling is hot pink. When I walk down the street with a little head peeping out of it, people stop and stare. I suspect this is what it's like to be an extremely beautiful woman, and so, just like I imagine a beautiful woman would do, I pretend not to notice the attention. But it's not only strangers looking at me, it's also my daughter herself. Since the day she was born, she's been unusually alert. Our very first night in the hospital, sometime around 2 or 3 a.m., I was exhausted and she was wide awake. But she wasn't crying. She was just lying there, wrapped in a little blanket and a little hat, gazing at me. Feeling her big baby eyes on me in the half-lit hospital room was one of the strangest sensations I've ever experienced. All at once, I had gone from watching to being watched.
Curtis Sittenfeld is the author of American Wife and Prep. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. We are here at the Aspen Ideas Festival. Now, we've ended up talking a lot about children tonight. There's a story we tell to children that actually, I think, has a lot of wisdom at this particular moment for we so-called grown-ups. Remember the ant and the grasshopper, the Aesop's fable? The ant is disciplined and prudent, while the grasshopper parties as if the good times will never end. And then winter comes, and the grasshopper is in big, big trouble. Well, Americans, I think, are both, bless us, energetic grasshoppers and energetic ants. We're kind of a bipolar crossbreed, which is one of the reasons we've been so successful as a nation. We've got, we Americans, the ants' Yankee virtues, sobriety, hard work, ingenuity. But then we also have all those qualities that make us American instead of Canadian. We are impatient, hell-bent, self-invented gamblers with the conviction that we deserve to make a fortune overnight. For the last quarter century, longer actually than probably ever before, we Americans have indulged our grasshopper side. Now winter has descended, and it's time to get in touch with our inner ant, to distinguish between what we want and what we need. Less party-hardy boomer, more greatest generation. Less Oz, more Kansas. And speaking of stories meant for children, since last fall, I've also been thinking about a cartoon from my own childhood, Coyote and Roadrunner. During the 80s and 90s, America was really kind of a nation of wily coyotes, manic and scheming, racing at maximum speed across the endless American landscape. Then in the first years of the 21st century, after the bursting of the dot-com bubble and 9/11, there we were, over the edge of the cliff, suspended in midair. And then finally, last fall, we looked down, and down we went. Now, in every Roadrunner cartoon, as you know, Wile E. Coyote is broken and battered multiple times, but he never dies, and he never gives up. And I don't think we will either. We will brush the ashes and dust off our coat and reattach our snout. But unlike Wile E. Coyote, we can wise up, get a little less manic, a little less greedy, stop trusting in credit default swaps and other dubious contraptions that we get by mail order. Stop thinking that we can acquire superpowers somehow. And who knows? Reality might turn out to be fun for a change. Once more, John Flansburgh, John Linnell, and Marty Beller, they might be giants.
Stop. As you fall, hear me call. No, no, no. Listen to this warning and consider these simple words of advice. Stop, stop, stop. Fogging the view, cupping face to the window. In darkness you make out a spiraling shape. Putting all reason aside, you exchange what you got for a thing that's hypnotic and strange. The spiraling shape will make you go insane. But everyone wants to see that groovy thing. Says it's great, and they heard it from the spiral in their eyes. This could lead to excellence or serious injury. Only one way to know. Go, go, go. Go ahead, wreck your life. That might be what's wrong or right. Nobody can. Put out your hands and you fall through the window, and clawing at nothing you drop through the void. Their terrified screams are inaudible, drowned in the spiral ahead and consumed in the shape. The spiraling shape will make you go insane. But everyone wants to see that groovy thing. And now that you tried it, you're back to report that the spiraling shape was a fraud and a fake.
Studio 360 is a co-production of PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC. And now, since we're back in 2014, don't forget to submit your entry to the 1914 Blues Challenge. We want to hear your version of one classic W.C. Handy song. You've got just a couple of weeks left, and all the details are at studio360.org. Today's program was co-produced with the Aspen Institute and The Atlantic. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferum,
Alana Harper,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Shruti Pinnamaneni.
Ed Haber and Irene Trudell recorded the show at the Belly Up in Aspen. Special thanks to Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
A teenager runs away and finds herself in New Orleans.
I was ready to have some adventure, make some friends, and really I thought, oh, maybe I'll learn how to be an electrician or something.
Instead, Alinda Lee Segarra started a band, Hooray for the Riff Raff. They'll perform for us next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.